Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Michael Rubin, senior resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael, welcome back. Your piece on Lockerbie is what I wanted to talk to you about. I listened to a BBC interview with David Miliband today, and the first rule of holes applies. The Gordon Brown government just keeps digging and digging and digging. Explain to our audience what we now know about what they knew about the release of the Lockerbie killer.
Well, what we now know is that it had far less to do with compassionate grounds and appeared much more to be a calculated play, not just by the Scottish Justice Minister, but by the Prime Minister himself and by the Foreign Secretary of Britain, to curry favor with the Libyans, commercial favor with regard to oil.
Now, Michael Rubin, I don't understand why anyone would risk that calculus. How much money could it mean? Why would Gordon Brown feel that? Because obviously he's not a dumb guy. This is consorting with terrorists. This is doing a deal with the equivalent of Al-Qaeda.
Well, you're absolutely right. And you could ask why anyone could think they could get away with it. And that's exactly the right question. The reason they thought they could get away with it is because they didn't think that there would be any consequences from the United States, that perhaps outrage would be limited, and so forth. Now, one of the big questions that remains unknown here is to what extent did President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton really try to head off this release before it happened? Did President Obama spend more time condemning Megrahi and this forthcoming release as he did the incident with the Cambridge policeman?
Do you believe that President Obama knew this was going to happen before it happened?
I believe a lot of people knew it was going to happen before it happened. The British had been signaling that a deal was in the works for at least 9 months.
That is really remarkable. Any downside for President Obama in this? I think Gordon Brown is toast, by the way. Do you agree with that as a result?
I do agree. I mean, it's not just the Libya issue. It's a perfect storm of domestic and foreign policy issues he's facing.
There was a book which I interviewed the authors, Douglas Franz and Catherine Collins, called The Nuclear Jihadist. It's the story of the AQ Khan Network. And in it is detailed the demilitarization of Libya in the aftermath of the Iraqi invasion, Michael Rubin. If they had said that this was part of that deal, that might have been palatable. Is there any indication that that is part of this deal?
No, there's every indication it was not part of this deal. Indeed, many of the people who helped strike the deal had said at the time that when the Lockerbie conviction came down, the understanding was that this man would be held for life. What we've seen a lot with the diplomatic rapprochement with bringing Gaddafi in from the cold, that was part of the deal, and I personally don't think that we've gotten as much from the deal as we should, but the release of this Lockerbie terrorist most certainly was not part of the deal.
All right, let's turn to Iran, Michael Rubin. A cabinet minister confirmed this week Ahmadinejad actually, I think, increased his fanaticism this week. Is that how you're reading it as well?
Indeed. What you can do is the whole course of Islamic Republic history, there's a slow and steady progression of narrowing the range of political debate. A few years ago, we had the reformists. Now the reformists are as banished as the liberals and the communists and everyone else. All we have left are the so-called principalists, Ahmadinejad's faction. And what's especially telling is his nominee for defense minister, who was confirmed by parliament yesterday, was confirmed with an overwhelming vote of more than 200 parliamentarians. This is the man who was responsible for the terrorist attack in Buenos Aires in 1994 against the Jewish Community Center.
So if you follow the trajectory of this, where does it take us and how soon do we get there?
It takes us to a much more extreme Iran, a much more militarized Iran, in which the ideology which underlies the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps triumphs. Ahmadinejad is a product of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, as are most of his cabinet ministers. What gets more and more dangerous, of course, is that the centrifuges continue to spin, and we may not only have this more radicalized regime, but we may have this more radicalized regime with an unprecedented amount of military destructive power in its hands.
Now, the McChrystal report from General McChrystal is in the president's hands. Most people assume it's going to call that there will be a subsequent call for additional troops. Is that your understanding, Michael Rubin?
Additional troops in Afghanistan?
Yes. And do you have any idea yet on what kind of number we're talking about?
I do not, but we have just a fraction of what we had in Iraq. I mean, up until about a year ago, all we had was around two full brigade combat teams in Afghanistan. But I'm afraid it's not just the number of troops that matter. One of the problems with the coalition, one of the problems with NATO involvement, is you have this really convoluted and illogical command and control and different rules of engagement, and the Taliban are simply exploiting that.
Now, I'm curious, if a confrontation between Israel and Iran erupts and that escalates with Iran making an attempt to pressure the United States, close the Straits of Hormuz, et cetera, will the troops in Afghanistan, because of their command by NATO, be available to any kind of American pressure on Iran at that point?
Well, the American troops will be. General Chuck Wald, who led the air campaign in Afghanistan, has written about this in a piece. I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks back. But the issue isn't so much the number of troops, because if there's any chaos, most of our reaction would be aerial. But just by having troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, that certainly provides cover for the insertion of special forces. No one's talking about anything like Operation Iraqi Freedom or Operation Enduring Freedom. What most people are talking about is an aerial assault supported perhaps by a small number of special forces who are helping with targeting and sabotage.
And are the American Navy's assets in the Persian Gulf and the surrounding waters greater than normal, or are they about where they have been for the last 10 years?
My understanding is they're about where they've been for the last 10 years. We really augmented the number of our forces in the Persian Gulf after around Operation Praying Mantis and the reflagging of the Kuwaiti tankers back in 1987. And we've been, on top of that, you had Operation Desert Storm, and we've been slow and steady since then. The problem with the Persian Gulf, which most people don't realize, is just how incredibly shallow and crowded it is. It never goes to a depth of more than around 300 feet, which means that it can be very difficult to maneuver, especially with Iranian small boats. But we also have a lot of assets available in the Indian Ocean, where we have much more range to maneuver.
So I almost ask you this every time you're on, Michael Rubin. I want to ask it now. Where do you see Israel and Iran going? What do you think the next 3 months holds, if anything?
I think we're going to know a great deal just over the course of the next couple weeks. President Obama had given Iran a deadline of the G20 meeting, I believe September 23rd, in order to determine whether Iran was serious about diplomacy. Now, if Iran doesn't respond by then, President Obama has said that we are going to have additional sanctions. Now, if the international community doesn't acquiesce to additional sanctions, Israel may conclude that the international community is not serious and that they have to take matters into their own hands. So I believe a real decision point will be later this month.
And when Israel reaches that decision point, do they have an incentive to move more quickly or to delay it any particular period of time? Anything going on that would cause them to delay a bit?
I'm not privy to their technical capabilities, but the longer, I think in the Israeli mind, the longer they wait, the more the Iranians have to harden their facilities. Now, a lot of people have actually said that given how far buried Iran's facilities are, that it would be impossible to really take them out with an aerial assault. What General Wald had pointed out in his Wall Street Journal articles, you don't need to destroy Iran's buried and hardened facilities. You only have to take out the entrances.
Michael Rubin from the American Enterprise Institute, I appreciate the time as always. I'll be right back, America.